Thank you for inviting us to Scotland. I love Scotland. I don't think it would be possible for me to explain to you why and how much, but I can try a little bit. I'll start by telling you that I have had two Scottish terriers. The first was a very fierce, very no-nonsense sort of dog, and so his name was McFierce. The second, McFierce came to a very sad end on the highway. The second was a much gentler and more loving little animal whose name was Macduff. And to my great sorrow, Macduff lasted only 6 years and died of cancer. I have not only had two Scottish dogs, I have had two Scottish husbands. As you would recognize, Elliot with two L's and one T is a Scottish spelling. My first husband's forebears were from the border country. My second husband's mother's name was Sterling, and his name was Leitch, L-E-I-T-C-H. My third husband, who is back there, whom you will meet today, comes from not very far away, Norway. And I've been very interested in learning just a wee bit of Norwegian to recognize that the old Scottish dialect that I have been reading for so many years has a good many similarities. That really fascinates me. I told Mr. Still this morning, and I think this surprised him, but this is the first time that I have ever been asked to speak to a group of ministers. And if I had known exactly what was going to be expected of me, I probably would have said no very quickly. I don't believe in women preachers. I feel very, very strongly about that. And I never speak in a mixed group in a church of which a man is not in charge. I'm a very lonely voice in my country. And I want it to be very clear that I speak under the authority first of Christ, under the authority of the Word, under the authority of my husband, and also under the authority of Mr. Still and you gentlemen who are leaders of this conference. But it is a privilege and a pleasure, and I thank God for it. I will not speak for 2 hours. When Mr. Still wrote to me and told me that I would have 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon, I said, well, I will not do that. It's not that I can't. I could speak for 3 or 4 hours, I think. But it is a sin to bore people. And it is a sin to bore God. And I think that there is a law of diminishing returns. If you load people with too much, then they begin to forget everything. So there will be a break in the middle of my two talks this morning, and just to give you a preview of coming attractions, there will be one talk this afternoon and one period of questions and answers, and you folks jolly well better come up with some questions. I will do my best to come up with some answers. If you are reticent about getting up and giving your question orally, I would strongly suggest that you write down any question that may come to mind in the course of my talks. The question need not relate to anything that I talk about. You can ask me anything. I certainly will not guarantee that I can answer it, but I will do my best. So it helps, really. It saves time, and it makes for more clarity if the questions are written out. Number one, I discovered that when questions are given orally, very often what people really want is not information, but the floor. And so I would be very grateful if you would limit oral questions to 25 words or less in order that I may repeat them over the microphone. But if you write them out, that will make it easiest of all. At any rate, that will be the last thing on the program. So now you know more or less what to expect. Another reason why I love Scotland is that I feel that my own life has been immeasurably enriched by the rivers of living water that have flowed from this little country spiritually. My father was a tremendous fan, as we say, of Robert Murray McShane. He loved Horatius Bonar's hymns. He read to us from Andrew Bonar, Andrew Murray, Graham Scroggie. I don't know how to pronounce these names, forgive me.
Doing well.
George MacDonald has been one of the primary beacons in my life. I've read almost all of his original novels before they were mutilated and put into modern American English, which they have done now, and I'm very glad that they are available to Americans who can't read the old dialect. But I think they've chopped out some of the more choice passages. But anyway, I've been reading George MacDonald ever since my sixth grade teacher in the public school read to us his children's stories, and I've been reading him ever since. Samuel Rutherford has fed me all my life. I remember the tremendous popularity of a novel called Beside the Bonnie Briarbush by Ian McLaren. Is there anybody here who's read that? I see one hand, two hands, three. I'm so glad. My parents raved about that book, and it wasn't until just a few months ago that I bought a secondhand copy of that book and just devoured it. Also, Alexander McLaren was another one that my father read from. My second husband, being a Presbyterian, spoke often of John Owen, and I guess was John Owen an Englishman? P.T. Forsyth was certainly an Aberdonian, was he not? And then I would have to speak of one of my spiritual mothers. My life has been enriched in ways beyond describing by a number of women, older women, who have been mothers to me. And one of those I've always called my Canadian mom, but she was Scottish. She had been the first white woman who lived on Great Slave Lake. Her husband was also a Scot, and he was one of the owners of one of the Hudson's Bay stations on Great Slave Lake. And I met dear Mom Cunningham when I was a student in Bible school in Alberta. And I will never forget the day that I heard a knock on my dormitory room door. I had only been in this school for a few weeks, and I was rather lonely and feeling rather like a fish out of water. There was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and here was a radiant pink face surrounded by white hair. And she said, "Are you Betty Howard?" And I said, "Yes, I was called Betty in those days." And she said, "Oh, dear girlie, you don't know me, but I know you, and I've been praying for you, girlie." Well, dear Mom Cunningham often invited me to her tiny basement apartment for a cup of tea and a Scottish scone. And she became a mother to me. She prayed with me and for me for as long as she lived, and was one of the instruments, I believe, in praying Jim Elliot and me together. But I think of all of these with a great lump in my throat. And I can't help associating a Scottish accent with spirituality. And I couldn't help being a little bit amused in the middle of Mr. Still's prayer when he spoke of the Lord's accents, hearing the Lord's accents here. And I thought, well, I guess the Lord can speak through an American accent too. It must be much more difficult. But for me, a Scottish accent has always been a spiritual accent. And so I thank God for all of these servants of his who have spoken to me the word, mostly on paper, but a number, those whom I have known personally. And I just wanted to spend this first few minutes, 25 minutes or so, telling you a little bit of my own story so that you will know where I come from. I grew up in a very strong Christian home. My parents were both 7-day-a-week Christians. There was no profession that was not also lived out in our home. We had a small bronze plate over the front doorbell that said, "Christ is the head of this house, the unseen guest at every meal, the silent listener to every conversation." My father took the view that if it was a parent's responsibility to feed his children 3 physical meals per day, it was certainly his most solemn responsibility to feed them spiritually. And so my father gathered the 6 of us children 2 a day to feed us from the Word. Every morning after breakfast, we went into the living room. My father led us in singing a hymn, and we sang straight through a hymn book, skipping none of the hymns and none of the stanzas. We then listened to my father read the word, and we all knelt to pray. My father did the praying, except when we all joined together in saying the Lord's Prayer at the end. And following dinner in the evening, we have dinner, not tea, he also read the Bible and prayed as we sat around the table. And I'm very grateful for that. We spent many evenings as a family sitting around reading in our living room. This was in the days, of course, before television, so it was not nearly so difficult to get people to shut up and sit and do something besides watch the tube in America. I don't know what it's like in this country, but we sat around and read books. And I can remember being quite irritated because my father was always interrupting our silent reading by wanting to read aloud from somebody like Robert Murray McShane. But I am grateful now for all of that rich heritage that I have. Ours was a home of order and peace because it was a home where not only were we children disciplined, but our parents set an example of self-discipline, which of course was the foundation of their ability to discipline us. And we understood that. It took a while for us to understand, but we began gradually to understand that love and obedience go together. And I feel that it has been a great deal easier for me to learn to obey God and to realize that his disciplining of me is the discipline of a loving father. That would have been a harder, much harder lesson to learn if I had not had a loving father who disciplined us. And so I'm grateful for that. We saw in action the love of our parents for God. We saw their love for each other. And I believe that it was George MacDonald who said that the greatest thing that a father can do for his children is to love their mother. And certainly the opposite would be true. The greatest thing that a mother can do for her children is to love their father. We also saw their love demonstrated for us. Another one of the great blessings of that Christian home was the presence of many, many missionaries. We had missionaries for lunch and supper and tea and breakfast and everything else. We read missionary books. We went to missionary meetings. We saw thousands of missionary slides. And we were told the stories at our dinner table from the very mouths of many of these great saints of God. And one of those who was not yet a missionary but was on her way to China was a young woman by the name of Betty Scott Stamm, a Presbyterian missionary who was about to go to China to meet her fiancé, John. She was Betty Scott when I first met her. I was just a little child then. She went to China. And a few years later, I remember the evening when my father came home from the office with the newspaper reporting the fact that John and Betty Stamm had been captured by Chinese communists and beheaded. You can imagine the impression that that made on an 8-year-old girl. I began then to realize that discipleship will be very costly. It may cost you everything. It wasn't until about 4 years later that I came across a prayer that Betty Scott Stamm had written, and I copied that into the back of my Bible because it came alive in view of the fact that this woman had sat at our supper table and this woman had actually paid the full price for obedience. And these were the words of the prayer: "Lord, I give up all my own plans and purposes, all my own desires and hopes, and accept thy will for my life. I give myself, my life, my all, utterly to thee, to be thine forever. Fill me with thy Holy Spirit. Use me as thou wilt. Send me where thou wilt. Work out thy whole will in my life at any cost, now and forever." And those three words, "at any cost," took on tremendous significance because of the way in which she had died. And she had been forced also to watch the beheading of her husband before they chopped her head off. It was when I was a student in boarding school that I began to pray that the Lord would make real to me many of the words of hymns that I knew by heart since before I could even remember. We grew up, of course, memorizing hymns quite painlessly because of having to sing them all the time. When we went to bed at night, we were not allowed to talk, but we were allowed to sing. And so we would have singing contests. My two brothers were in two other rooms down the hall. There were only three of us back in those days. And we would see who could sing the loudest and the longest, but it didn't usually last very long because we would fall asleep. But I remember beginning to realize when I was 14 years old that I was singing a whole lot of almost lies, but I began to pray that the Lord would make them true in my life. And one of my very favorite hymns was "Beneath the Cross of Jesus." And it says, "I take, O cross, thy shadow for my abiding place. I ask no other sunshine than the sunshine of his face." And I was stopped cold by that. I thought to myself, could I possibly pray this with any real sincerity? I wanted all kinds of sunshine besides the sunshine of his face. But to pray such a prayer as I did at that time, "Lord, make these words true in my life," is also going to be costly. It wasn't until I was a college student that I learned the hymn, "Oh, teach me what it meaneth, that cross uplifted high." And the old rugged cross was another favorite of mine. I suppose any hymn that speaks of the cross, "In the cross of Christ I glory, towering o'er the wrecks of time. All the light of sacred story gathers round its head sublime." I began to pray that God would indeed teach me what it meant. And God took me up on that, as he does. And he does it always in unexpected ways, doesn't he? The will of God is always different from what we expect. It's always much bigger than what we expect. It's always probably more costly. And the great thing that is so hard, it's quite impossible to persuade those who have not yet decided whether they really want the will of God, to persuade them that it's true. But the great thing is that the will of God always leads to joy, ultimately. But it was when I was a student in college that I began to agonize over the question of whether or not I was willing to be a single missionary. It was no problem at all for me to tell the Lord that I was willing to be a foreign missionary. I believed that that was what God was calling me to do. And it was when I was in my third year in college that I believed God confirmed that call, and that was a thrill. But I began to contemplate the specter of being an old maid, and I did not like that image. I knew some old maid missionaries, and I preferred the married ones. And so I said, "Now, Lord, would you please just give me some guarantee or some indication at least that you are going to give me a husband one of these days." It didn't look very likely because I was what we used to call a wallflower in high school and college days. There was no prospect whatsoever on my horizon. But the Lord did not give me such a promise or guarantee or even a hint. He said to me, "Trust me." In effect, he was saying, "It is none of your business what I'm going to do tomorrow or next week. Take no thought for tomorrow. I want you to trust me here, now, today, whatever my will may entail." And so I realized that the prayer that I had prayed, "Lord, work out your whole will in my life at any cost," was now being tested. And my prayer, "Oh, teach me what it meaneth, that cross uplifted high. Oh, teach me what it cost thee to make a sinner whole. Oh, teach me, Savior, teach me the value of a soul." And the Lord was saying, "Would you rescind that prayer? Did you mean it? Were you asking for my will or the working out of your own?" And of course my answer had to be, "Lord, it's your will that I want, your way, whatever, your plan, your design." And so once I had said, "Yes, Lord, if it's singleness that you want to give me for the rest of my life, I'll take it," then of course God has to test the validity. Not that God doesn't know whether it's sincere or not, but God has to give me the opportunity to find out for myself whether or not that prayer was a true one. And so then, to my great astonishment and dismay, I discovered that I was falling in love with somebody. Somebody who had never given me the slightest reason to think that he would ever look at me twice. He was what we used to call on that campus a BTO, a big time operator. He was popular, visible, handsome, smart. He was the campus clown. He was the president of the Foreign Missions Fellowship. Everybody knew that this man, whose name was Jim Elliott, was headed to the mission field because he had a very unsettling way of going up and grabbing fellow students by the arm or the lapel and saying, "Hey, buddy, how come you're not going to the mission field?" And if they stumbled and stuttered around and said, "Well, I don't know, I just don't know whether I really feel called," Jim's response to that was, "You don't need a call, you need a kick in the pants." He was the president of the Foreign Missions Fellowship. He was a campus clown. He was a wrestler. He won the championship of 4 states in his wrestling class, and on top of all that, he was a classical Greek scholar, graduating with highest honor in classical Greek. So I had my eye on this man, as did probably a few hundred other women on the campus. Particularly, he was fascinating to us because he never dated anybody. So we thought Jim Elliott is a woman hater. Well, it was very far from the truth. He had learned in high school that women could be very fascinating and a terrible waste of time and money. And so he decided when he went to college that he wanted to get 2 degrees. One of them, Wheaton College was qualified to confer, the Bachelor of Arts. The other one, no college or university on earth is qualified to confer. It's the AUG, approved unto God. And Jim had taken as his verse for those 4 years of college, the one in 1 Timothy, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed. And he decided that it would be quite impossible for him to get both the BA and the AUG and be distracted by women. And so he simply deleted them from his schedule. Well, I haven't got time to go through the story of Jim Elliot in detail. You can read that in the book Shadow of the Almighty. But suffice it to say that just before I graduated, only a few weeks before I graduated, Jim still had another year to go, he confessed his love to me. I had no idea that he had any interest in me whatsoever. That was a stunning announcement, but it was followed by an even more stunning announcement, which was that, as far as he knew, God wanted him to remain single, perhaps for the rest of his life. Well, what were we to do with this? I began then to understand that the cross is going to touch the deepest places of a woman's soul. And we found, as we sat in the park the day that he told me that he had been in love with me for months, we sat on the grass and talked about this strange pathway along which God had been leading us. We found that we had both been struggling over the question of singleness. We found that we had both found ourselves interested in somebody that had showed no interest in us. And we found that we had been memorizing the same scriptures, things like, "No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly," and the same Amy Carmichael poems. Now, for a woman to find a man who was a fan of Amy Carmichael was just too incredible. But we had both memorized, "Lord crucified, O mark thy holy cross on motive, preference, all fond desires, on that which self in any form inspires, set thou that sign of loss. And when the touch of death is here and there laid on a thing most precious in our eyes, let us not wonder. Let us recognize the answer to this prayer." Well, it was 5.5 years before God brought us together. We had both been single missionaries, uncommitted to any but God himself. We had no promises to each other. Jim had said, "I'm not asking you to marry me. I cannot ask you to marry me. You go ahead and go to Africa if that's where God wants you to go. I'm going to South America. And if God wants to bring us together, it's his business. It's not ours." And so he did, in fact, bring us together after many long and painful years, very painful for me, in the longing and the unfulfilled longings, the separation, the uncertainty, and just the lessons in trust. What else? What would I expect God to do in order to answer my prayers to learn what the cross means? And dear Mom Cunningham in Canada was praying all those years, among others. There were others also who were praying about Jim and me, my parents among them. I went to Ecuador in 1952 to do linguistic work. Jim had gone to work in the eastern jungle with a tribe called Quechuas, the modern descendants of the Incas. I went to work in the western jungle with two English women who had not had linguistic training. I had had linguistic training. The Colorado language was unwritten, and so my job was to write down the language. Skipping very quickly over that year, there were three major blows to my faith in that very first year as a jungle missionary. If you're going to learn an unwritten language, the most essential person is to find someone that we've called an informant, one person who speaks the language, who is willing and has the patience to sit down with this apparently retarded foreigner and speak over and over and over again what for him is the easiest language in the world. And it was very difficult to find such a person. I found that the Colorado Indians were very wealthy. They never had worked for a white man in their lives. and they certainly were not going to work for a white woman. To my great amazement, I discovered that there was a man there who was bilingual. He spoke both Spanish and Colorado. His name was Macario. He was a Christian. He was delighted to work for me. He needed a job. He was prepared to work at my price. And so God answered exceedingly abundantly above my prayers and gave me Macario as an informant. We began to work very efficiently together. He would sit there and simply repeat again and again, as long as it took me to try to imitate what he said and write down on paper what he said, and then the next day I would read it back to him, etc. But we had not been working together for very long, perhaps about 6 weeks, when Macario was murdered. And, of course, my first question to God was, why would you allow such a thing to happen? And again, God did not give me an explanation. He simply said, trust me. And then, during that year, Jim Elliot, having had experience in the jungle, had decided that God was not asking him to remain a bachelor, but that a wife would not only not be an obstacle, but she would be an asset. And he figured that if I could do pioneer jungle work alone, I could do pioneer jungle work with him. So he sent me a telegram asking me to meet him in the capital city of Quito. I went to Quito. He proposed, and we were married 9 months later and began to work together among the Quechuas. But I had to move to the eastern jungle in order to fulfill a condition that Jim had put on the end of his proposal, a very stringent condition. He said, I will not marry you until you learn Quechua. Well, I had already had to learn Spanish in Colorado, but now I was going to have to start at the bottom rung of another language ladder and start learning Quechua. So I went to the eastern jungle and hadn't been there very long when I had a letter from one of the two English women working with the Colorados to tell me that all of the language materials that I had amassed during that year had been stolen. There were no copies. This was in the days before Xerox. There were no tape recorders. Everything that I had done was in one suitcase. It was all gone. And what do you think I said to God? Why, Lord? 1 year's work, in effect, down the drain. The message of relinquishment. The cross means relinquishment. The lesson in giving over my passion for Jim Elliot was a severe lesson in surrender. And here was my work, my feelings first for Jim, yours, Lord. My work relinquished with no explanations. Well, I went then, finally, after fulfilling Jim's condition, I did learn enough Quechua to satisfy him, and we were married, and we worked together with the Quechuas, reducing their language to writing in order to do Bible translation. He and I had just finished the book of Luke in first draft in the jungle Quechua dialect when Jim participated in what was called Operation Auca, an attempt to reach yet another tribe not related to the Colorados or the Quechuas, people who had never heard the gospel. Jim had been praying since he was probably a high school student that God would someday send him to a tribe that had never heard the name of Jesus. And so we had been praying for this, and when the opportunity came for him to participate in Nate Saint's Operation Alka, a program of dropping gifts to these Stone Age people, Jim was thrilled. Never have I seen him more exuberant than he was that day when Nate said, would you participate? And Jim said, would I participate? And so he went to the Alcas. Does that mean it's 12 o'clock? My watch is wrong. I thought I had 3 minutes. May I take three more? Oh, reset my watch for the next talk, I promise. You know, most of you know the story, but anyway, he went with four other missionaries, and they had what appeared to be a very friendly contact with the Alcas, and 2 days later were speared to death. When I got word that my husband was missing by shortwave radio, God brought to my mind immediately words from Isaiah 43, verse 2, "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee, for I am the Lord thy God." And I realized that once again the Lord was not giving me a preview of coming attractions. He was not giving me a promise that he was going to bring my husband back alive. And of course I tried to persuade him that if he didn't think I needed Jim, certainly our 10-month-old Valerie needed a father, and certainly the Quechua Indians needed him. But God was simply saying, "Trust me. Will you trust me? Did you ask for my will at any cost? Did you ask me to teach you what the meaning of the cross is?" And the answer had to be, "Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord." And so he said, "I gave you the gift of singleness for much longer than you wanted it. We were 26, both of us, when we were married. I gave you the gift of marriage to the most wonderful man in the world, and now I have given you the gift of widowhood. Will you take it? Will you accept this with no explanations as the sphere in which I want you to glorify me?" What did my answer have to be? As Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, the love of God leaves us no choice. It's the expulsive power of a new affection. I said, "Yes, Lord." And so the cross touches the deepest places of our lives, but it also touches us in the little things every day. It is a choice. My will or God's will? My way or his way? The rule of heaven is, "Thy will be done." The rule of hell, "My will be done." And so that's as far as I will take you in my story. And you know a little bit of the background now. My next talk will be on the subject of spiritual fatherhood and motherhood. I just want you to know that my husband Lars is used to hearing me talk about the first two husbands. And he gets called Mr. Elliot quite often. And he says, "Never mind, I'm Mr. Elliot the third." So for those of you that were feeling very uncomfortable and edgy for poor Lars, I just want to put your minds at ease. He sometimes says, you don't talk enough about number two. Well, I don't have time to talk about all of them, do I? And the reason that I go by the name of Elizabeth Elliot rather than Elizabeth Elliot Gren is not because I am a feminist who refuses to take her husband's name. I do have his name, but it's a bit much to expect my audiences to keep up with all my marriages, isn't it? So Lars is back there saying, "That's enough of that." I mentioned Mom Cunningham as being one of my spiritual mothers. And the more I see what is happening in my own country, and of course I can only speak from what I see there, I don't know very much about what goes on in your country, but the more desperate I see the need to be to fulfill the commands of Titus 2, where Paul instructs the young Titus as to how he is to teach men and women, older men and older women, in his church. And I cannot thank God enough for those who have been my spiritual parents. My own parents were, of course, the most important spiritual parents of all, but not all have that kind of a background. And as I travel around, I find that there is an absolutely desperate hunger on the part of younger women for spiritual mothers, spiritual fathers. And there is what one Christian writer has called a crisis in masculinity in our country. Men are refusing to grow up, refusing to take the responsibility of being fathers and husbands. And if they haven't thought about being fathers and husbands in the ordinary sense, they have thought even less about what it means to be fathers in the spiritual sense. My son-in-law, Walt Shepherd, who was here in Scotland in January, once asked our friend Dr. James Packer, "What do you think is the greatest need in the church?" And Dr. Packer's instant reply was a holy pastor. And perhaps the greatest need of the holy pastor, with apologies to Mr. Still, is a holy wife. If you have a wife, may it be that she is a holy wife. I would not suggest that every pastor is supposed to have a wife, but for most of you, it certainly is an asset, isn't it? And it ought to be an asset rather than a hindrance, a liability. But the greatest need for the church is holy ministers. The greatest need in the home is holy fathers, holy mothers, holy wives, holy husbands. And what does this mean? What does it mean to be a spiritual parent? In John 17, verse 19, Jesus said, "For their sakes I sanctify myself." If Jesus had to pray a prayer like that, how much more need is there that we should sanctify ourselves, we who are so sinful, so inadequate? I watched one of those beautiful nature programs on television showing the emperor penguin, and I will never forget the scene of those great tall birds standing on the ice of the Antarctic with the wind sweeping across. And I learned what I had not known before, that the emperor penguin, the father, incubates the egg. And here were these thousands, just a sea of male penguins standing, each with the one egg covered by feathers on top of his 2 feet. And they stand for 3 months in the Arctic wind on the ice. And when the egg is finally hatched, then and then only can they go to find food. So they have almost starved to death by the time the 3 months are up. The mother then comes along and takes care of the chick for a while until the father comes back. And they take turns caring for the chick, but it is the father that takes care of the egg. And I thought, what a picture of responsibility. What a picture of fatherhood. Because, first of all, fatherhood means responsibility, doesn't it? And those of you who are fathers in the physical sense know that the responsibility is implacable and continuous. And it's much greater than you could have ever imagined before that first baby was born. I only have one child. And the day that she was born, I was overwhelmed, literally to the point of tears, at the responsibility that suddenly belonged only to Jim and me. We were the only human beings on earth that were responsible for this little child, this little pink package. And it was as though God put me on my face in the utter sense of inadequacy. And I said, Lord, there is no way that I will ever be able to raise this child, even for 1 year. It is too big a job. The will of God is always bigger than we expect it to be. And I don't suppose God ever asks us to do anything of any importance that isn't bigger than we think we can do. And he does this in order to put us on our faces with the acknowledgement of our helplessness. I think that's probably one of the reasons God gives us children and animals. We are faced with mystery and with responsibility and with something that the mystery certainly ought to humble us when we think about it. What is this incredible human being? And I'll never forget the fact that within 30 seconds after Valerie was born, the doctors laid her over on a sort of a table beside me, and I looked over at this baby, and to my utter incredulity, she was looking at my eyes. I thought, why isn't she looking at the ceiling or the lights or at my feet or something? But she was looking at my eyes, just as if there was recognition there. Incredible. But it puts us on our face. It makes us, it should humble us if it never does anything else. But the picture of those penguins spoke to me of responsibility, which means sacrifice, and patience. Three things that characterize fatherhood: responsibility, sacrifice, and patience. I just saw some, I've forgotten whether he was an athlete or an entertainer, somebody who was being interviewed on one of the ubiquitous talk shows in the States. And they asked him about his children, and he said, oh, he says, you know, when the first baby was born, he said, I took one look at him, and I said, well, I guess he's cute, but I'll be down at the bar if you need me. And I thought, it just seems so typical of so many fathers who have no idea of being fathers. I know one young man who divorced his wife when his second son was 1 week old, and his reason was that he just decided he did not want to be a husband or a father. Well, I thought that's rather poor timing. He would never be able to get out of being a father. He was still a father, whether he liked it or not, and had abandoned two little children. We have a pond near our home where there's a swan that sits on eggs about every 2 years. And again, I was reminded of the patience and the sacrifice of that mother swan who sits there in the very, very cold, icy Massachusetts winter. The swan, the salmon, what lessons we can learn from them. The male salmon gives his life in order to give life to the next generation. We are people, we who belong to God, are people who bear a solemn responsibility for the spiritual training of others. And when I thought of this august company which I was meant to address, I thought, it is too awesome. I can't think about it too much, but I do realize that I'm speaking to leaders and teachers and examples who bear the responsibility of the training of others. All of us must sanctify ourselves for their sakes. Jesus said, he that would be great among you must be the servant of all. In America, there's a proliferation now of seminars on leadership. I hear a great deal about leadership. There are lots of books on the subject and people taking courses and videos, and you know what I'm speaking about, just endless programs for producing leaders. And I wonder if any of them start out with Jesus' words. He that would be the first among you must be last. He that would be greatest must be the servant of all. If I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you must wash one another's feet. Be willing to take the lowest place. But spiritual responsibility is first of all to God. He is the giver of this responsibility. To be a father in the physical sense is to have been given a child for whom you must answer to God. And the same thing is true, of course, in the spiritual sense. Where are these men who are prepared to lay down their lives? I would guess that here's a room full of them right here. I doubt that you would be in a conference of this nature unless you were. But I hope that my words will simply encourage you in the job that God has given you to do, and just perhaps remind you again of what a glorious and eternally significant role it is. We are to recognize that our responsibility is first to the one who has given these people to us. Secondly, it is to those over us, and all of us are under the authority of somebody. We are not islands. We are not a law unto ourselves. And perhaps it's very difficult for any of us who are gifted with the qualities of leadership and the position to submit always to those that are over us. We are a bunch of prima donnas, perhaps by temperament and by nature. But we must be submissive to those to whom God has given us. Those who are over us are responsible for us. We are responsible to submit to them. And then we are responsible to our children. In Hebrews 13, verses 7 and 17, the writer says, "Remember your leaders, those who first spoke God's message to you, and reflecting upon the outcome of their life and work, follow the example of their faith." There's a great fear in my country now of heroes and leaders of any kind. I was discussing this with a group of young people just yesterday afternoon in Aberdeen, asking them who are their heroes, and I found that there was exactly the same reluctance. There was a dead silence when I asked, "Who are your heroes?" And to me that's very sad, because when I was a child, when I was a young person, I had dozens of heroes, people to whom I looked up, people who set examples for me, people whom I wanted to emulate. And when I couldn't get any answer on who are your heroes, then I said, "Well, whom do you admire?" And a few of them were able to mention one or two people that they admired. And then the next question, "Is there anyone that you want to be like?" When I asked this question of a group of young people in the States, the answer was no to all of them. They did not know anybody that they really wanted to imitate. And of course, there's the danger of putting people on the pedestal, and we've seen such tragic and very egregious examples of Christian leaders in our country who have been put on pedestals with an enormous following and almost adulation and idolatry, and then have fallen very far. But here it says, reflect upon the outcome of their life and work, follow the example of their faith. It's a little scary, isn't it, to think that a good many people are looking to each one of us to follow the example of their faith. And I find it overwhelming at times to realize that whatever I've put down on paper, there is no way I can ever change. And here's this array of books, and like Pilate, I have to say what I have written, and I can never change it. I can never change a word. And because we stand up and speak and write and teach, we are obligated to be scrutinized. And people have a right to scrutinize our lives, to see whether there is any life that backs up the words. Just in the last less than 2 years, I've been given a radio program, another one of those things that just completely dropped, as it were, in my lap. I had nothing to do with looking for it. But now I'm even more conscious of the need to pray this prayer. For their sakes, I sanctify myself. I'm responsible to these people. And in verse 17 in the same chapter, obey your leaders and defer to them, for they are tireless in their concern for you. Is that true of you and me? Are we tireless? Or do we sometimes just feel as if we've had it up to here? And of course Moses felt that way, didn't he? He got so sick of the people of Israel that he said to God he'd rather be dead than have to bear them around. He said, did I give birth to these people? Do I have to nurse them in my bosom like a nurse? I'd rather die. And that's certainly a human temptation, I'm sure, for some of you. Defer to them. They are tireless in their concern for you as men who must render account. Responsibility. Let it be a happy task for them and not pain and grief, for that would bring you no advantage. So let's remember to obey our leaders, to remember that they are men who have to render account, and remember that those under us have a right to look to us as well. In 2 Corinthians 5, verse 15, we have one of the many verses which describes why Jesus came to earth, why he died. I've been making a list of as many verses as I can find that put in just a few words why Jesus died. John 3:16 would be one that would certainly spring to your lips. But 2 Corinthians 5:15 says he died for all so that men, while still in life, should henceforth cease to live for themselves and live for him who died for them. We are to cease to live for ourselves. We are not our own. We are bought with a price. And Jesus' first condition of discipleship was give up your right to yourself. So you are fathers, like it or not. You are charged with that responsibility. And may I speak to you women who, because you are pastors' wives or about to become pastors' wives, are going to be judged by a much higher standard than anybody else. And I hear pastors' wives complaining about this all the time. I have one friend who is a pastor's wife, and she is just, to me, the most exuberant, the most joyful example of what a pastor's wife should be. And she said, if I could write a book, she said, I would write a book about the tremendous privilege of being a pastor's wife. She said, I am so sick of hearing pastor's wives complaining about how awful it is to be under scrutiny all the time and to have to live in a fishbowl and have to do all this entertaining. She said, it is the greatest job in the world. She said, I can't be thankful enough. And right now, her husband has terminal cancer. And she is every bit as joyful. Both of them are. She is just taking one day at a time. She said, we just want to learn everything the Lord has to teach us, one day at a time. And I think, what a privilege is yours. My daughter is a pastor's wife. I have never been the wife of a minister. I was asked to speak one time to a group of over 100 ministers' wives, just the wives, as I said. I've never spoken to a group of ministers and wives before. And I called my daughter. She was then, I think, 27 or 28 years old. She'd been married a few years. And I said, now, I've never been a minister's wife. What shall I tell these women? And the first thing she said to me was, you tell them to give and give and give and don't expect to be thanked. And I said, well, all right, I will tell them that since you are the voice of experience. But I said, I know what they're going to say to me. They're going to say, well, I don't know whether I feel comfortable with that. And what about my needs? And doesn't anybody have to give to me? And that's all I do is give and give and give. But I don't see why people don't have to thank me. And Valerie said, you tell them, I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. Of course it's their responsibility to say thank you, but that is not your business to extort thanks from them. It is our business to pour out. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Live in my love. Now, how did he love us? Thanklessly. Long before we had the slightest idea that he had done anything for us. I remember my second husband, Addison Leach, saying that a lady said to him, I work my fingers to the bone for this church, and what kind of thanks do I get? And he said, what kind of thanks did you expect? For whom do you labor? Is it those people primarily? It is the Lord Christ that we serve. What will it be to see him and hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant? I get asked a whole lot of very strange questions by interviewers, and one interviewer really surprised me by saying, what does Elizabeth Elliot want to be remembered for? And I thought, my goodness, I've never thought of such a thing in my life. But I had to answer something, and I said, well, I just want to be a faithful servant. That is my highest goal. But it is a solemn responsibility to serve the Lord Christ. He that is faithful in little things is faithful also in big things. He that is dishonest in little things is dishonest in big things. You women are an example. It doesn't make any difference whether you want to be, whether you choose to be. The fact is, the job has been dropped in your lap. You are being watched, not only by the women in the church, but by the men as well. What sort of a wife does this man have? Is she a godly woman? Does she submit to the rules of Titus 2, 3 to 5? Is she a mother? Does she teach the younger women how to love their husbands, how to love their children? Everywhere I go, I see unruly children. I see young couples trying to cope with absolutely no idea how to make these children behave and how to make them obey. My mother not only mothered us six children, but she mothered many dozens of other young women who came to her and said, how do I make a two-year-old come when I say come? And leave it alone when I say don't touch? It's your job. Whether you have children of your own or not, you know what the Bible says. And so we bear this solemn responsibility. There's a passage in Isaiah 22 that gives a beautiful description of a father, of fatherhood, which I had never seen until just a few years ago I came upon this. Isaiah 22, verse 21, he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the people of Judah. I will lay the key of the house of David on his shoulder. What he opens, no man shall shut, and what he shuts, no man shall open. He shall be a seat of honor for his father's family. I will fasten him firmly in place like a peg. On him shall hang all the weight of the family down to the lowest dregs. All the little vessels, both bowls and pots. And I thought, now that's a wonderful description of a father. He is a peg on whom hangs all the responsibility of the family. And I think the feminist movement has done a terrible job in our country in persuading men and women that they are equal and more or less interchangeable. And so the father's supposed to bring home half the bacon and do half the washing up, and the woman is supposed to bring home half the other half of the bacon and do half the washing up. And the father says, well, I will give the children breakfast and send them off to school Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you will give the children breakfast Tuesday and Thursday, and then we have to work out how we're going to work Saturday and Sunday to make sure that you do your half and I do my half. And it's a diabolical program. It completely flies in the face of what the scriptures tell us. Masculinity means responsibility. To quote Dr. J.I. Packer again, when I was working on a book on the subject of masculinity, the book called The Mark of a Man, I said to Jim, what do you think of when you think of masculinity? And just like that, he said, responsibility. On you hangs the weight of the vessels. But we women have another kind of responsibility. We are under the same authority, under the same creator as the emperor penguin. And God assigned that job that requires responsibility and sacrifice and patience to the male penguin. And he assigns to us the responsibility to be spiritual parents. In my country, sports has become a religion. It is the cultural substitute for religion. And believe it or not, in the state of Texas, it is true that churches have to rearrange their entire program in order to accommodate football. Nobody will be there if there's a football conflict. And I have nothing against sports per se, but when they become an idol, and when the father of a family spends all day Saturday and all day Sunday on the playing field or sitting in front of the tube, something is seriously out of order. Where is the sense of responsibility? And I'm getting floods of mail as a result of my radio program. Just had a letter last week from a woman who said that she married her husband 14 years ago. She said we were both in our teens. And she said he started right off by spending all day Saturday and Sunday in sports. She said we now have four children. He never has changed his program. He is out on the playing field himself. And the children can do whatever they like, but they don't have a father. He has made golf orphans out of his children. Responsibility does require sacrifice, doesn't it? And that is the second thing that I want to say about spiritual fatherhood and motherhood. The first thing, in case you've lost track of my outline, we are responsible to God, we are responsible to those over us, we are responsible to our children. And secondly, fathers and mothers are meant to be a living sacrifice. And in Titus 2:3-5, Paul speaks of the things that older women are to teach the younger. First, we are to set an example by reverence in our bearing, not gossips or scandal mongers, not slaves to strong drink. And I have a sneaking suspicion that Paul might have added something to that slaves to strong drink. Nowadays, I don't suppose I'm speaking to anyone who is alcoholic or a drug addict, but anything at all that we simply have to have to the detriment of others or to the inconvenience of others can be an idol, can't it? And we become slaves. We are not to be gossips. And then he says they must set a high standard and school the younger women. Now that word school means to teach primarily by example. He was not suggesting that women should start seminars and do videos and teach Bible classes necessarily. That may be the job of some. But the women in the church, he said, they are to school the younger women. It is their responsibility. I've had younger women come to me when I've told about my spiritual mothers, and they've said, where can I find one? And some of them have actually gone to older women in their church and said, I need a spiritual mother. I don't have a Christian mother. I have never had a Christian mother. Would you help me? And they have been turned down. The women have said, oh, I wouldn't know how to do that. I'm not a Bible teacher. Well, I've said to those young women when they say, well, how can we find one? I say, well, you probably can't find one, be one. Remember that if you're 20 years old, there are 15-year-old girls looking up to you. I remember what it was like. When I was 9 years old, there was a 15-year-old girl who lived next door to me. And she was my idol. She was my heroine. I wanted to walk like Ruth and wear my hair like Ruth and dress like Ruth. She was a lovely Christian girl. And she was very kind to a 9-year-old. Unusual, I think, for a 15-year-old girl to pay any attention to a 9-year-old neighbor. But there was a sense in which she was a spiritual mother to me. Not consciously at all. I'm sure she would be absolutely flabbergasted if she heard me speak of her in this way. But she did what Paul is talking about here. She set an example. She schooled me in what it means to be a lady. Schooling the younger women to be loving wives and mothers. They don't know how to love their husbands. They don't know how to be a mother. And the world is coming at them with tremendous force and insistency and garbage. Telling them, don't spank your children, that's child abuse. I watch these talk shows because I need to know what kind of nonsense my radio audience is listening to. And there was a talk show just recently on this whole subject of what they called hitting a child. And they meant spanking. Now, to me, there's a world of difference between a calm, controlled use of the rod that is spoken of in the book of Proverbs, a measure of pain inflicted for a very good purpose, and what is so feared nowadays, child abuse. And there was no distinction at all made between those two things. You can't hit your children. That's what they were saying. And when one person on the panel said, well, I do believe in spanking, they said, well, it's absolutely wrong to use violence on your children. But it says here that the younger women are to be loving wives and mothers. School the younger women to be loving wives and mothers. Temperate, which means self-controlled, chaste, and kind, busy at home, respecting the authority of their husbands, thus the gospel will not be brought into disrepute. And we are in a very vulnerable position where it's very easy to bring the gospel into disrepute. Are your children under control? Do you know how to teach another mother or father how to control his children? My stepdaughter and her husband live in Bowness, and we were there the other night, first night we arrived here in Scotland. They have 4 very beautifully behaved children. And when we questioned them about that, they said, the discipline of children is preached in our church, and our children must be under control. Busy at home. Can you imagine getting up in America in a public place and telling younger women to stay home? Another translation of this same passage, I'm using the New English Translation here, but another translation says, teach the younger women to stay home. When I suggested to this group of pastors' wives that they should be setting an example by staying home themselves, I was mobbed when the thing was over. There were tables of 10. This was a luncheon, and there were tables of 10, And I had read somewhere that 80% of American ministers' wives are working outside the home full time. And I made mention of this, and a woman came charging up to me. I could see the belligerence in her face as soon as the talk was over, and she said, "I don't see how you can possibly stand up there and say things like that to a group of women." She said, "I did a poll at my table. There were 10 of us here," and she said, "8 of us do have full-time jobs outside of the home." Well, I can't solve that problem. It is not my job to define all the possible exceptions. There are no footnotes here in Paul's letter to Titus. He didn't say, except in this case or this case or this case. He didn't qualify it. He said, the older women are to teach the younger women to stay home. I am an older woman. I'm going to stand up and tell them what the Bible says. I said, if you have a situation which you believe is an exception, you don't have to answer to me. You need not defend your case to me. You have to answer to God. So take it to God. But there's something wrong in our country. One of the things that I know is wrong is that there are a good many Christian husbands who are forcing their wives to take jobs outside the home. I have no idea what the situation is here or what it is in your churches, but I would plead with you to do everything that you can to present this pattern. And then whatever problems and impossibilities are thrown up in your face and say, well, we can't possibly do this, the economic situation is such that we have to have two incomes, etc., etc., the responsibility lies with the husband. The buck stops at his desk, and what I want to say to these Christian husbands is, are you prepared to make it possible for your wife to stay home and take care of the children that God gives you? I believe with all my heart that women were made to be responders, we were made to be receivers, we were made to be mothers, certainly in the spiritual sense, if not in the physical, and it's perfectly clear that God does not give physical children to all of us, but he does give spiritual responsibility. And in order to be mothers and to do that job and to be at home so that we are available, then we have to be provided for and protected by godly husbands who understand that this is God's pattern and are prepared to make any sacrifice. And I have heard wonderful stories from women whose husbands had insisted upon their getting jobs, and they had, in submission to their husbands, gone ahead and done this to their own great sorrow, and yet in obedience had done it, but had been praying to God that he would change their husbands' minds. And I have heard some lovely testimonies as to how God has done this. We are to be a living sacrifice. And in order to do that, we are going to have to be inconvenienced. Love is the willingness to be inconvenienced. Children are a tremendous inconvenience, aren't they? A whole lot of trouble, as my second husband used to say. He had 3 daughters. He used to say they're a whole lot of trouble at both ends. And to be a spiritual father and mother means to be inconvenienced. And the measure of your love is the measure of your self-giving. The measure of your willingness to sacrifice. Inconveniences are small sacrifices, aren't they? But this is indeed what God wants us to do. And as I think it was St. Francis de Sales who wrote, that no redemption will ever be wrought without the pain of the one who loves. We're in the redemption business, are we not? As cooperators with God in his bringing the world to himself. And I'm sure that it was St. Francis de Sales who said that it is that the King of Glory rewards his servants not by the dignity of the office, but by the humility with which it is performed. Are you willing to be available, as dear Mom Cunningham was, many afternoons, available to me, available to any number of other girls. I went back to visit her years later when commencement was taking place, and as I sat with her during the graduation, by that time she had become the dean of women in that Bible school. She had just been the wife of a staff member when I knew her. And she was now the dean of women. And one girl after another, as she went up onto the platform to get her diploma, dear Mom Cunningham leaned over to me and whispered, "Oh, Betty dear, if you knew her story." And she knew the story of every girl that went across that platform because she had been their mother. When she told me that when they had asked her to be the dean of women, she said, "Oh, I could never be a dean, but I could be a mom." And that's what she was. Will you be spiritual fathers and mothers, taking responsibility and being willing to be a living sacrifice? God bless you.